G'day Groovers, welcome to another instalment of the U Project. Craig Anthony Harper reporting in for duty. Tiffany Ann Cook over there at TYP Central. How's your morning? It's very early here in Melbourne.
Isn't it great to have a reason to get up early?
Oh, listen to you, the bloody happy little thing that you are.
Yeah, well, I had my miserable days for a day or so, so now I'm happy again. I've bounced back.
Well, she did throw the dummy out of the cot, everyone, when we went into lockdown 72 here in Melbourne, and she wasn't happy for a day or two. You had your bottom lip out. You were sooking and sulking. Are you all right now?
I'm good now. You know, it's just important to be able, we were talking about this before, it's important to be able to express ourselves when we're feeling things. That's my new thing.
Well, yeah. Anyway, we are in, for those of our friends from around the world, we're in lockdown number 5 in Melbourne. And so I'm Robinson Crusoe in the house again. That's all right. What's it? Moran Cerf is our guest. We're going to go deep on who he is and why he does what he does. But we welcome you to the show, sir.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. I didn't know that I get you not just in a box on my window, but actually in a box somewhere in Melbourne. So I'm sorry for the lockdown.
Well, that's okay. We only need somebody to sneeze in Melbourne and we go into lockdown. Our premier is somewhat trigger happy on the lockdown button. Like literally, it's a significant issue, of course, but we have literally had 2 COVID deaths in Australia this year. 2. And in Melbourne right now, I think we've got how many cases? Or now we're in a state of 7 million people and we have, I think, about 10 cases or something. But literally, as soon as there's any hint of anything, we go in, and this is lockdown number 5 for us. But now we know you're in New York, Moran. What's the status there? What's the COVID status now?
I think that for the most part, the city went back to normal, as in all the restaurants are open, people are walking out, no masks. It seems normal. But I think that the new COVID variant that's starting to surge gets people like myself, who are in the kind of medical fields, a little bit concerned. So we are starting to ask questions like, what needs to happen for you to go back to lockdowns, to go back to masks, to minimize events? And it's right now just academic conversation. It's not really decisions. But my memory is that when those conversations started about a year and a half ago, it was quickly that soon after that we had to make a choice. So I think that we're going to soon have to make additional choices about that.
Yeah. Well, now I hate to say what I'm about to say, but it's true. But there's a good ending to the bit that starts not so good. I had no idea who you were 2 days ago. I don't know how I'd never heard of you. And Tiff organized our chat. And I went, I better find out who this bloke is. And obviously there's an abundance of you on the internet. I went, and this is what I typically do. I try not to find out too much because I want to find out on the show. Well, I watched a bit of you and then I can't fucking stop. So I had to keep watching. So I watched video after video. And now I feel embarrassed that I didn't know who you were. And I never get nervous because I interview lots of people and I've worked on television and radio. And then this morning I was feeling a bit nervous because I've got a bit of a man crush. I'm like, fuck, this dude is a superstar with brains and minds and he used to rob banks and he's a hacker and he works on TV shows and movies and he presents all over the world. I don't even know where to start. Tell my audience, yeah, maybe we'll spoon on the couch later if you've got time. Tell my audience about your bank robbing days.
Sure. So, you know, first, I would say that no matter what I do with my life, you know, I've been an academic for now 15 years. No matter what I do with my life, robbing banks is going to be the thing that I'm going to be known for. like no matter what, you know, even if it's been something I did years ago. But here's the behind the scenes. I was a child of the 80s, which means that I grew up with computers and I learned how to work them and how to kind of get into them and play with them and so on. It happened to be that I turned 18 in Israel right around the time where internet became a household thing. And I was recruited to the Israeli intelligence. And that's when I was surrounded by others like myself who were mini hackers as kids and now got supercomputers and lots of money to actually hack into nations. So I was trained by the Israeli military for almost 4 years on how to do it with massive budgets. And when I finished, I started as a civilian, a company that was doing the same thing, but for hire, meaning we would be hired by banks or by government institutes to try to hack into their own systems and show them if there are any vulnerabilities. And we did it for a while. And one of those institutes was a bank that hired us not just to virtually get into their systems, but also to actually come and rob the bank the old-fashioned way. And that story, no matter what I do in my life, will always be the first thing you know about me.
Now, I need more information because I heard you talk to Tom Bilyeu about that. When you say you went and robbed the bank the old-fashioned way, did you kind of do a forward roll into the bank with a shotgun and then and a balaclava on and scream at everyone? How did that transpire?
So it looks pretty film worthy in that we did go to the bank and we did go to the teller and say, hey, please give us the safe and the note and everything. But it's not as glamorous as we didn't have like a sock on our face and like two holes for the eyes and a shotgun, partially as a decision to minimize the chances of someone actually acting like a hero and starting a gun battle on the bank. So we did that. We essentially came with only a note and a kind of instructions, but we knew the bank really, really well. And we knew that they were instructed, the tellers, to respond to a bank robbery just with a note the same way they would if it were someone with a shotgun. So it was a real bank robbery from that perspective.
Now, bloody interesting. Okay, so now let's say you come in the bank, I'm the teller, you pass me the note, you're robbing me. For all intents and purposes, I believe this is real. Mm-hmm. And I'm starting to hand over the money. I'm doing what I'm told. I'm complying. How long after that moment is it before I know that this is fake?
So in reality, the entire experience of us entering the bank, doing a transaction, it could be sometimes taking money, it could sometimes be taking information and leaving the bank would take no more than 10 minutes. That was our kind of plan. Maybe, 12 minutes, but essentially it was supposed to be quick. So that's kind of reasonable. I would say that it feels like hours. Mm. So when you walk into a bank, knowing what you're about to say, the 10 steps from the entrance to the teller, which take a second, feel like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Every word you say feels like minutes long. And yes, when they fumble with the records for like 10 seconds, you feel like the world's falling apart. Yes. It feels like it's very long. You it hear the sirens like, behind
sounds
me.
Like the cop, sounds like the cops are coming now, mate.
Yeah, that's New York for you.
That's so for you, as you were doing this, like obviously you're not a bank robber. You know, that's not your default setting. You're not a criminal. Well, not that we know of officially. Let's just keep that under the hat. But so you're walking into this bank first time as a essentially to pull a heist. How was your emotional state? How was your anxiety?
So I would say that it's terrifying. You can't prepare for that. As in you rehearse and you make plans and you essentially do it in the best circumstances, as in you call someone in advance and you tell them, we're going to do it in this branch. And you have tons of safety nets, as in someone outside ready with instructions. Everything is working towards it being the easiest experience. And it's still frightening, terrifying, and kind of something that you can't prepare for.
Yeah. I wonder if you did it. Did you do it a few times? I know that you hacked into banks quite a lot. How many times did you do that three-dimensional real-world experience version?
So we did it three times successfully. So the story is, pay attention to the word successfully. We did it, I think, two more times unsuccessfully, as in like someone right away said like no, or immediately press a button and the doors lock and so on. So we also had the bad experiences of that, which then, means in the best case scenario, that you immediately have to kind of call someone from the outside that comes and says, here's a note that says it's okay, and we let you know in advance, and they call your CEO because we told them in advance. That's the best case scenario. And the worst case scenario, which also happened, is you get arrested and you have to start arguing all of those things from jail.
Yeah. That's hilarious. What about
you get out usually?
Now, I'm going to let go of the bank robbery thing in a minute, but I'm a bit fascinated. So what about the trauma of the person that thinks they're literally being robbed?
So big topic. So we actually had to spend a lot of time asking this question, and I'll expand and say that, first of all, there is a shock, and you have to kind of be prepared in so many levels to them having a bad experience. And what do you do then? And we had some, you know, precaution, like we had a person outside who was ready to come in on. So we had some things, but I would say more than that, that's a concern that exists even not when you come to a bank and say, hey, let's give me your money. Also when you rob a bank virtually, because for the 3 hours from the moment you robbed in a bank virtually, as in logged in, stole someone's money and then gave it back. It's the same thing. Someone logs into their account and they used to have X and now they have zero.
Yes.
And no matter what you do, that's a shocking experience. That's actually, in a way, something that scientists deal with all the time. What do you do when you create an experiment? It could be a heist or it could be an experiment where you make a person feel like they lost or you make them feel bad. How do you do that? And we have some protocols, both robbers and scientists, to when do you tell a person that you lied to them, that there was a little bit of a hoax there, that their loss or failure is only in the game. Like it's a concern that we always have to deal with. And right now, as a scientist, I can tell you it's a concern that comes up all the time. When you lie to people in a science experiment, you have to at some point tell them we lied to you and it caused you some distress and you maybe felt like you failed, but you didn't, and so on. Always a concern. It's a bit of a situation that we have to deal with case by case, and mostly it is left to you to, on the spot, make up how to deal with that.
Yeah, and just last one before I move on. So the people who all of a sudden they realize, okay, this is not real, this is simulated, this is a simulation or whatever, and I'm sure it varies, but is their response more towards the relief end of the scale or the anger end of the scale or confusion?
So I'll tell you, it's kind of like a candid camera thing where the person themselves who was, you know, the teller in the bank or the surrounding, they're always happy, relieved, find it funny, and kind of become part of the team and want to come work for us. That's the first thing. The people who are the supervisors, whose bank basically was robbed, the people who hired us, the people who actually care about not just like, you know, the moment to moment, but the long-term consequences, were always responding in the same way, which is the wrong way. They immediately found a way to explain why this particular case where it worked out was unique and it will never happen again tomorrow. So they say, yeah, okay, you managed to break the bank today and steal the money, but it's because it's Tuesday, June 24, and this guy that was a teller was not the right one. If you came tomorrow, it wouldn't work. So we never managed to convince people whose banks we broke into that they have a problem that they need to think about kind of bigger picture as a solution. And most times they just say, okay, fine, we'll solve this one and then we're secure. And we kept telling them, no, you're not secure. It's an ongoing thing. The fact that we told you how to do it once and you know how to stop this time wouldn't stop us from doing it the same way tomorrow with kind of a different person.
Well,
and this never happened.
You don't want to let evidence get in the way of a good story, Moran.
I agree.
I mean, like the thing is, when someone has a story in their head and they get their sense of confidence and even self-worth and self-esteem or whatever from that story, and then you come along and go, your story's bullshit. They don't, even though you've just proven that, and even though there's data, they don't want that.
I agree. That was exactly it. People find how to believe that they're vulnerable.
And let's talk about that. Let's expand on that, because, you know, obviously I'm fascinated with the mind. You're an expert with the mind and brain and human behavior and processing. And so, I mean, this is a metaphor, really. Like, this is life. Things happen in life which have no meaning until there's a human involved. it's just a thing that happened. And then you put a human in the picture, and then the human interprets the thing and says it means X. And then another human says, no, it means Y. And another human interprets it and goes, no, it's completely Z. And you know, so obviously the on a personal level, the human experience is a subjective interpretation of all these objective things. Is it impossible for a human to be objective because we look at life through a subjective filter?
So you said it perfectly. I wish I could say it as beautifully as you did just now, because we try to explain this complexity all the time and we constantly find it difficult to articulate. The brain loves narratives, and it's really, really hard for our brain to be in a state that doesn't have a narrative. You wear an underwear and you play basketball once and you win. Your brain immediately says, it's the underwear. That's it. The blue underwear is what makes me win. And then you wear the same underwear a second time and it wins again. It says, that's it. Like there's no, and then you wear it three times and the third time you lose. And it's supposedly just another data point, but immediately you say, well, this time it's because I was wearing the lucky underwear, but also it was raining today. So that's why the story doesn't change. It's still the lucky underwear. It's very hard for our brain to just say things happen and there's no meaning. There's no narrative behind it. There's no kind of some cause and effect that we can come up with. We constantly are kind of likely to find meaning in things. People who meditate, not me, and you know, try to practice that, essentially are working on doing this one thing to the brain, to kind of put it in a state where you don't come up with an answer, where things happen and you kind of observe them from the outside and you say, okay, this happened and this happened. And I'm not immediately saying that A leads to B and that B is the opposite of C. You just try to kind of witness things as they are. It's very hard for the brain. It's good that it's hard for the brain, because it's good that our brain constantly comes up with answers. Most times the answers actually help us, but at times those answers work against us. And at times we come up with the wrong answers and we stick them because they play a nice story on us. And I think you said it perfectly. That's really, really difficult. And it's our natural state.
Mm. And also I think we humans don't like uncertainty and we don't like unfamiliarity and we like to know. And if we don't know, we'll make something up. So we feel like we know. And it's like one of the two frequent conversations I have with people, I was raised in a really religious paradigm, right? But as I'm older, and I'm not an atheist, I'm open, right? But people ask me, what do you think happens when we die? I go, I don't know. You know, it's like, for people, the idea of not knowing is more terrifying than almost anything. So they have to have a story. And I'm not saying their story is right or wrong, but especially with something as, you know, intangible as life after death, the truth is none of us know, but we want to think we know. So we have an idea and a story and we call that information. Well, that's not information. It's just a story about something we don't understand. So I think that propensity to want to know, and if I don't know, I feel fearful, so therefore I know.
I agree, it's 100% right. Like religion comes mostly in places that we don't have answers and we can't get answers for those. Mm. And I think that generally people that are charlatans thrive on weaknesses of knowledge. If you don't know something, someone's going to come and give you the perfect answer. I typically one that also makes you a hero, and then you cling for that. I think that most religious people not only believe that Jesus is going to come, let's take Christianity, that Jesus is going to come at some point, but they also believe it's going to come in their lifetime, because it only means something if I'm here to see it. If I dead at noon and he comes at 1 p.m., what's the point? I'm no longer here to see it. It's part of the narrative that it's an answer and we're the center of the answer. It has to be something that kind of gives me meaning, not just meaning to the world, but me in the world.
You know, I'm going to share something now that you don't need to know, but my listeners will be interested in and you might find interesting. So I was part of a church in the 80s, and the pastor of our church taught that we were in the last days, right? You probably heard this, the last days, right? The end, they call it the end times. And that like you said, Jesus was coming back and we're heading into a cashless society. And this is all comes out of the book of Revelation, which is the last book in the New Testament. and that it says in the last, it says in Revelation that nobody will be able, in the end days, nobody will be able to buy or sell unless they have the mark of the beast. You've probably heard of that, right? And so we were all taught and told that this is going to happen in the next few years. And we were told not to own property and all of these things, right? And every single person in the church believed this, right? This was not a thought or an idea. This was like, this was to us, this was a fact. But the other thing about being in a an echo chamber, right, is that you are not allowed to question anything. And the moment that you think beyond the group think, you're an outcast.
So I think we trashed religion a bit. Let me say something positive about about the brain's capacity to believe in things that are not there. I think that this property of our brain, that it finds meaning in everything, that it quickly comes up with stories, that when there's an uncertainty, it will fill the gap with something, is also one of the strengths of humanity. It allowed us to actually believe things that are not there as society and work with them. So there is no such thing as a unicorn. It doesn't exist. But one dude sometime invented a unicorn, maybe wrote a book about it, or maybe told a story over next to the bonfire to their friends. And they were all able, using this remarkable thing of the human mind, it's not even like something animals have, only humans have this capacity of the frontal lobe to believe the same ideas and share them, such that unicorn suddenly became a meme in other brains. And they all had the same idea. None of them saw it, but they all had the same shared idea. And they could go and share it with others. And this allowed humans to believe and to kind of concentrate around an idea in beautiful ways. Unicorns are not that helpful to us other than creating a mythical experience, but democracy is another idea like that. It doesn't exist. You can't wear democracy, you can't eat democracy, but one guy invented it, told others, and now we all vote in the same way, we all operate in the same way, we all believe the same thing. Money is another thing like that. We invented money and we work like this. You can go to philosophy. Love is maybe something like that. There's a poet that I like, French poet, said, I don't know if I would fall in love if no one told me it existed. Once we created this thing, we can all work with that. Yeah. And in that sense, I think humans are fantastic in coming up with things, operating by them, and creating organized kind of thinking around some of those ideas, which makes us thrive. So religion is the bad outcome of some of those things, because it makes us do things right now, because sometime in the next world, there's going to be 72 virgins waiting for me, or something like that, which, you know, makes us do things right now that might hurt us. But also the good things of that are that we can do fantastic things as society without actually seeing the outcomes right now.
Now, you make a really good point. My mum and dad are super Catholic, and I'm really glad they are, because they've got confidence about where they're going, in inverted commas, when, you know, when they pass away. And that gives me confidence that they're not scared of dying.
And they're happy, right?
They're happy. That's right. That's the bottom line. Moran, what's the mind? What's the mind?
Okay. You gave me the easy ones first.
I just see how I do that. I just kind of build rapport. It's my thing. I build rapport. I create connection. And then when you're not really switched on, I throw you under the bus.
Okay. So, but I'll build on the previous one. I think brain, we understand, that's easy, that's tangible. Mind is another of those, one of those ideas that we invented as society and we all believe in, and we're kind of flexible on the tangible aspect of that. We don't mean the same thing when we talk about it necessarily, but we all have a sense of what it is. It's kind of like there's a Supreme Court judge in the US that said something I really like in one of those big famous trials that went all the way to the Supreme Court. He said about pornography. He said something like, I don't know how to define it, but I know it when I see it. And I think that mind is kind of like that. So I'll say right away, it's the set of attributes that sum up all of our wishes, desires, decisions, the agony and ecstasy of our existence, the sum of all of our thoughts and beliefs in one. As a kind of encyclopedic answer. And for a pragmatic purpose, it's the things that we can do with a brain that we can't measure. So here this was my kind of academic answer. I'll give you the more intuitive one that makes sense. A lot of times people come to me and talk about the brain and consciousness. That's kind of the thing that everyone wants, consciousness. Explain to us how this works. And we as neuroscientists know how to explain how the brain works. We don't really know how to explain how consciousness works, even though we have some theories. And some scientists would just say, okay, well, brain is consciousness. That's about it. If you build a brain, you got everything. And that's where a thought experiment that I can play with you and Tiffany comes right away that will tell us where you stand on that. And the experiment goes like that. We tell you, Craig, welcome to our lab in which we build a duplicate of your brain. So now that you're here in the lab, we can take every atom of your brain, every cell, every neuron, and put it in the replica. And now in the aquarium, you have a one-to-one copy of your brain. Whatever thoughts you have, that copy has, whatever dreams you have, it has, whatever wishes you imagine, it wishes and imagines. So perfect copy. And now we offer either of you, Tiffany or Craig, the following deal. You're gonna get $1 million. Let's take a nice sum of money. You get $1 million. That's the reward for participating in the experiment. In return, what we're going to do is we're going to kill you. And you're going to take your body and you're going to put a duplicate in the body. So the brain that you have right now with your body live with extra $1 million. It's just that we kill you before. Don't worry. There's a duplicate of your brain and everything that you have is in the duplicate. So it's just killing you, but everything that you are is going to leave this room. And the question we ask people, are you going to take this deal? Will you take this deal of you being dead, but a duplicate goes with $1 million or not? I can let you answer right away.
Well, of course, I'm going to say no, but maybe other people would say yes. I'm going to go with a big fat no.
So that we've tried that when we actually ask people, and the majority, over 90% of people, over 99% of people, I think there's minor group of people that actually say yes, most people say no. And the interesting thing is not just the answer, but also the why. So when we ask people, why do you say no? There, the mind versus the brain come to life. Because what I just told you is we copied everything about your brain. Will you take this thing? And if you are a believer of the brain is everything, then you should take the deal. You should say, yeah, well, everything that is me is now in this replica. And it's basically gonna be me living with $1 million. It will feel like me. But if you believe that there's something additional, something that we call the mind or a soul or a psyche or something that is beyond the material aspect, then you say no, because you believe that they won't copy everything because there's something that is not tangible, something that they can't copy because it's not measurable, because it's not physical, because it's not in the thing that is my brain. And that's where the explanation to what the mind is comes. It's this thing that is the gap between the physical and the extra.
Yeah. Well, if somebody said that to me, it wouldn't be, my hesitation would just be that I don't believe them. I'm like, I reckon they might fuck it up.
We got that. So the two common answers are.
Sounds good, but you could offer me $1 billion. My answer would be no. I want to ask you, so when we talk about ideas like soul and spirit and intuition, are these terms that we make up to try to explain things we can't explain?
So it's a useful thing to have a language for concepts that we want to investigate. And scientists struggle with that. I'm the descendant academically of a professor who studied consciousness. And every time he started giving a talk, he was stopped by the audience and said, wait, what do you know consciousness? And he had to come up with a kind of dictionary type answer to what it even means, because by saying consciousness is this, you kind of already confined your investigation to a set of things. The fortunate thing for me and for him was that his academic advisor was a person who studied life, which is even more complex and abstract, but this guy actually discovered DNA. He won a Nobel Prize for that. And he, without having any answer to what life is, was able to explain how replication happens, how evolution works. So he got the Nobel Prize for that and paved the road for us all to keep studying things without having a good answer to what they are and still work with it. It's kind of like pornography thing. We study it. We all think we understand the same thing. We ask questions that go in the right direction, but we actually are struggling with having answers. And that's true for consciousness, for life, for things like the things I study right now, which are engagement. We try to understand what makes people engage in content. It's also loose and abstract, and kind of two people can mean different things. The good news is that typically people kind of understand the same thing. So even if we don't have the perfect answer, we're able to work with a murky explanation and kind of go in the same direction. And that's okay for me, even though I wish we had a perfect definition, because it would mean that the studies are easier. You can just test A or B.
Mm. So fascinating. All right, let's take a left turn. Tell me about working in films and TV shows. So you worked on, I'm sure you get sick of these questions, and I apologize, but I've never asked you these questions, and my audience have probably never heard the answer. So I apologize for the groundhog dayness of these questions. But so you worked on the TV show Limitless, or was it the movie?
Yes.
The TV show or the movie?
Both. Started with, of course,
Bull, which I love both Limitless, the TV series, and the movie, and I love Bull. What else have you worked on?
I had a little bit of an in on a show called Mr. Robot, a big in on a show called Falling Waters, about dreams, and a little bit of a in on a famous popular show called House on Doctors. So a few of those, the shows in a number of films.
Yeah, awesome. And what was that fake drug? Was it AZT or something?
Yes, I forgot the word. NZT, I forgot now. So here's the behind the scenes story. First of all, I went to school in Los Angeles at Caltech. It's a small school that happens to be in Los Angeles. It happens to be close to Hollywood. And sometimes people from Hollywood wander into the school with questions. They put up a film or a TV show, and there's like a doctor that injects something. And that's when they say, oh, we wish we knew what would be the name of the drug that the doctor injects, or what CC should be said. So they come in and kind of say, hey, you're a biologist. Can you tell us in this paragraph what to put? And you have to say, oh, doctor, give me 20 CC of benzodiazepine. So that's kind of where the science comes and ends. They come to us with one question, one paragraph, we read, we put a word, and they go away. I like doing that, and I did enough of that to merit an invitation to the actual film to see how they use it. And I kept having more ideas and more suggestions. And at some point I said, okay, this kid is maybe worthy of having under our umbrella. And that's how the term science consultant became part of my life. I basically started getting more calls from films and productions. And I think they liked that I also knew the way it works, and also that I don't give them too much trouble when they don't use my words. I think that the other scientists gave them a hard time when they started insisting that you do it the right way and not have any flexibility.
Imagine if one day they pissed you off and you just gave them some bullshit advice and they plugged in some science bullshit into their show.
It's funny you say that, because one time I was involved in a show and they gave me a long script, and it was very elaborate, and I spent a lot of time putting the science in all the places. And then I actually went to see the filming, and none of the things I said were there. And I went to the director and I said, hey, what's going on? Like, where are all the things that I said you should put there? He said, oh, we cut those out. And I said, then why did you have me go through all the motions of coming up with all the answers if you're going to cut them out? I said, oh, that's easy. So we can put in the titles, science consultant, Moran Surf, and then we get all the headache of other people asking us how we come up with it. So that was his answer. So sometimes they just use you so they can get rid of all the criticism and move on. I would say this is not the case anymore, because the audience became recently so particular. They pause the TV show and they look at the screen's text, and if there's a problem there, they would email the authorities and they say, in this movie there's a problem. I have a colleague who is a scientist, and he one day emailed, I think, who was it? I think James Cameron from Titanic, and had issues with Titanic, because Titanic, you know, we know exactly when it sunk, we know where it was, we know everything about it. And the production who made the Titanic's kind of famous scene where the ship sinks, they just put the stars by taking a JPEG and just putting there. And he said, we know exactly how the star constellation should be on the day of. How could you know that? Actually, they were even lazy. They only did half and they copied it. So you can see that the frame has the same stars on the left and the right. They were even lazy. So he emailed them angrily and he said, like, we know everything about this one thing. Why didn't you make an effort? And James Cameron responded and said, you're right. And on the director's cut that came out a year after, they fixed the sky. So the sky is now correct the way it was on the night of the Titanic sink. So sometimes you'll find people like that, annoying scientists who pick a scene, freeze the movie, and argue that it's not okay. In Mr. Robot, the show that I was marginally involved with, people used to freeze and look at the scenes of the text on the screen and email us if there were kind of screenshots that were not right. So now we actually have to do this because people pay attention and it becomes like a badge of honor to do it right at the level of like a freeze that you win.
That's anyhow, hilarious.
I started telling you about how I got there.
I think that scientist who analyzed the sky in the Titanic, that dude needs to get a hobby. But anyway, that could have been a lady. But seriously, come on, bro. What are you doing? go and invent something and help the world. But I think you're right. I think there are a small percentage of people who take great delight in finding faults and flaws in TV shows. That's okay. I think I've found it. I think I watched a Gladiator movie once with a bloke who had a watch on, a really, yeah, really old one. There's a few of those. So in the back to Limitless just quickly. So the concept in that was that someone invented a drug called AZT, this pretend drug that essentially supercharged the brain and made the brain work, you know, exponentially better for a period of time. So we have a very watered down version of that these days for real, which we call, or I think it's in a classification called, is it nootropics?
Neurotopic, yes.
Yeah. So tell us about those, like just a minute or two, nootropics, what are they, how do they work? Do they work? Are they safe?
Safe, yes, because they've been vetted. I mean, if you buy ones that have, you know, the right labels and they're not from the streets. So, yes. Do they work? Questionable. So, I mean, there are enough of them that you can kind of ask the question about each and every one of them. I think I would say kind of as, without going into one by one and like just kind of, it's a little bit like vitamins, which we know are tested and we know they're FDA approved and we know whether they work, questionable. They work in that there is the vitamin that you need in the pill there, but you need to eat them in the right time. And it's much better if you have them with meal rather than without meal. Same with those neurotropics. Like as a general guidelines, they wouldn't be out there if they didn't work. But if you ask me whether this is better than exercising, eating healthy, sleeping well, and so on, the answer is no. It's still much better to trust our body to do its job than to basically supercharge it by things that help it. Now that's a tough thing to say because our podcast is going to come today and tomorrow there might be one that changes and whoever listens to that needs to listen in the context. But right now, the few that I got to kind of play with and learn about, they're good. Like it's always good to have zinc. It's always good to have, I don't know, this and that kind of chemical in your brain in the right amount, and they really say the right amounts. But I would say that the kind of superpower evidence that we're looking for, that is really like kind of before and after, you're weak before you take it and you're alert, we have not found any of them doing that remarkable thing that kind of changes life. And if you're looking for something as an audience to help you, I would say sleeping better, having a healthy conversation with people, exercising, eating healthy will always be more useful for you than kind of relying on the doing poor job on those and getting some drug that kind of gives you the power. Yeah. I'll say one more thing that sure would be kind of a helpful. Some drugs, and those neurotropics are far kind of weaker on the amounts, dosage compared to the others, but some drugs actually have bad outcomes. Yeah. And those pass all the approval and they still have bad outcomes. I'll give you an example. There's a famous story, it's now over 10 years old, so it's probably kind of dated, of a drug that basically was used for people with Parkinson's that give them essentially more dopamine. So when you have Parkinson's, what you're missing usually is a dopamine chemical. And there was a drug that gives people with Parkinson's dopamine. So they were given this drug and it fixes the problem that they have, as in their tremor stops, or if they want to initiate action, it happens. So fantastic. But over time, those patients who got this drug started to become gamblers and risk takers and so on. And it wasn't what the test looked for. So it took some time to even figure it out. The partners, the husbands or the wife or the kids started saying, hey, dad is putting a lot of money in risky stocks or going to Las Vegas more and so on. So it took a lot of time to actually figure out that there's actually a consequence of the drug. That is this thing, and it is because dopamine makes you actually activate parts of the brain that are more likely to lead to risk-taking behavior. So within, I think, 10 years, it was discovered that the drug fixes one problem but creates another, and all they could do at this point is change the label. So now if you buy the particular drug, it says on the label, if this drug makes you feel like you want to gamble, please call your doctor. That's the solution. And I think that the drugs that are affecting the brains on other dimension could have this outcome that we really don't know of. Like, we look for whether it makes you healthy or not healthy, but we never do a test that asks the question, does it make you be mean to your sister? Or does it make you feel like you're interested more in gambling and so on? So there's a chance also that what I said, that we don't find anything bad about them, will end up not being true, because we find that the bad things are not in the same realm that we looked for, but they're somewhere else. And that is a thing that every people in the audience who's looking should also ask themselves, kind of, am I changing across the board or just in the domain I was looking for?
Yeah. Tiff, I definitely don't want this conversation to finish.
Me either.
I just want to keep going. Now, in all of the stuff, my somewhat extensive research yesterday, listening to you, I didn't hear you talk. You probably have, but I didn't hear you talk about placebos and nocebos. And I'm imagining that would be an area of interest for you.
It is, and I'll give you and your audience new stuff from neuroscience, not by me, but by others, but something that came in the last year that is relevant to that. So generally, the idea of placebo is interesting to neuroscientists, right? Like, it's interesting because you take a drug, we tell you that it's real, it's not real, and you get better. The only thing that happened was that your brain got information, and somehow this led to you being better. So this means that your brain does something and that affects your health. And for a while, this was kind of obvious, but we didn't have an actual result from a study that kind of showed how it works. And about a year ago, I forget if it was just like the last year kind of looks blurry to me. So I can't remember if it's 2019 or 2020, but in my mind, in the last year, because it came while everyone were at home quarantining, a paper came out that spoke to that. It basically suggested that the brain activates the immune system differently when it thinks that it's going to do a good job. So the placebo's outcome, effectively, brain-wise, is that you thinking it's going to work makes your brain activate the immune system more. So in the end, you actually get better. So it's not that it's what we call placebo is as if nothing, like you just lie to yourself. What happens is that you get a sugar pill, you think it's real. Because you think it's real, your brain tells the immune system, do extra work, we're about to get better, help the pill do something, and you actually get better. If that's the case, it means that we can now replace placebo with a different drug that just activates the immune system. So the more we know about how placebo works in the brain, we can create drugs that actually help us get the outcome without the need to lie to you. And that's where I think the science is going to kind of help us very soon.
You know what I love about that, right? So when you give somebody essentially a pill full of nothing, they're healing themselves without knowing that they're healing themselves, right? So what this tells me is obviously if you know, the next thing for me is, well, what's the correlation between the psychology of belief and the physiology of healing? Because it's not about the pill, because the pill's inert. It's about the belief. Now, imagine if we could train the, because, you know, if I think I'm in danger now, but I'm not in danger, but that's my belief, then my body creates a stress response, you know, blood pressure, adrenaline, cortisol, sympathetic nervous system, all created by the thought that I'm in danger when I'm not. And so when you give someone a pill full of nothing and they get better, like that for me is that's the, how great would it be if we could teach people how to heal themselves and not even need to be given a pill, because they actually don't need a pill. They just think they need a pill.
So here are two thoughts on that. So first of all, I would say I'll start as a small disclaimer. Sometimes some things don't work at placebo. Like if some things you'd need the pill as is, it doesn't matter if you believe or not, like you need this chemical in your body. So immune system can get you far, but not throughout everything. If you need some chemical and you don't have it, it doesn't matter if your immune system kind of, you know, overclock itself, it's not going to work.
So there's a legitimate need for medicine. Yep, of course. Yep.
So now the two points I was going to say that are interesting. One is there is an important, and I think you're in the world of health would probably pay attention to it even more than the usual. There is something about the brain's involvement in how we incorporate pain and deal with it. So if I'm going to borrow an example from a friend of mine, Sam Harris, who's, he is a big in meditation. And he would say the following. If you were to wake up middle of the night feeling the same pain that you feel after the gym, you would call 911 in the US and you rush to the hospital because you think that something is not right. But the context of you feeling this pain after the gym makes you accept it and say, uh-huh, okay, that's just like the outcome of me exercising. I'm going to go home and rest a little bit and feel that's actually great pain, right? So pain is by itself not just the end result. The context of the pain makes you actually deal with that in crisis mode or in fantastic mode. So the same pain, wake up at 2 a.m., terrible. After the gym, my body is doing its job. And in that sense, the brain is the decider on how to interpret a lot of things. Pain is one of them. When you feel the pain, it's already happened. The brain already experienced that. And now it's you wanting less in the future, wanting to process why the causes of that has made it arrive and so on. In that sense, the brain is super important in interpreting things like disease, like pain, like health, and so on. And that's point number one. Point number two, I was going to say, is that our research right now asks exactly the question that you pointed out to first, which is how come the brain changes our experiences so much in things that supposedly should be objective, meaning take the world of sports. We know that teams win games in their home base more than they win when they go outside. In theory, this should not matter. Like LeBron James shouldn't, if he trains all his life to throw a three-pointer, what does it matter if mom screams at him, LeBron, you're great, from nearby in a home game? Or if she's not there to scream and he's just like by himself. But we know it does. We know that some things actually are different because our brain controls the body differently. So actually LeBron, because he's distracted when he's outside, because his dexterity is a little bit lower because less hormones are being released, something happens that leads the same person in conditions that are different outside to behave differently. In that sense, the more we understand how to change your brain to make you feel like you're in a home game when you're not, to make you feel like you're after the gym when you're not, we can start navigating pain, pleasure, performance, and so on. And that's where a lot of scientists like myself are starting to spend time right now in just measuring how the context changes your brain so we can give you different contexts and make you feel better. A long monologue, but I hope it was clear.
No, I love it. It's amazing. All right, let's do one more and then I'll let you go because you've been very generous with your time. So
invite me again if you need more. I'm always happy to talk. Invite me again if you need more. We're going to do sessions after sessions in the future. I'm going to have new results.
Do not say that because I will become a straight up stalker. You know that. No, you're
on lockdown. Let's do it. If you have lockdown number six, I'm committed.
I'm not forgetting lockdown number six. We're getting you back anyway. tell me about researching people's brains while they're in the middle of an operation and they are awake and you are doing shit to their brain, for want of a more medical, clinical, scientific term. That seems terrifying to me.
Yes. Okay. So I'll explain. This is how we do our research mostly, by working on people's brain while they're operated on and they have electrodes inside their head. Generally,
can I just hit the pause button? I'm just going to say that everyone again because Moran has an accent and speaks very fast. They do most of their research while people are being operated on, and they put stuff in their brain while they're being operated on and they're awake. Yep. Keep going.
So here's how it works. Those are patients who have some brain problem. That's why they are operated on. It's not that we're doing it on each and every person randomly. We pick patients, and those patients have a unique disorder that requires brain surgery that usually isn't just like a momentary one where you open the brain, fix something, wrap it up, and leave them fixed. You actually keep them in hospital with open brain for days, weeks. So a typical one would be a severe epilepsy. If a person has epilepsy, it means that there's part of their brain who starts operating or speaking or kind of acting without any prompt. And this makes other part of the brain respond. And before long, you have a seizure. Like all the brain kind of starts answering a question that no one asked. That's basically what a seizure is brain-wise, which means that if we can find the part of the brain that started speaking, the first neuron that spoke without any prompt, and we take it out, we can actually stop the entire epilepsy. You won't have any seizures anymore. We'll just figure it out. So now the question is, can we find the one neuron in your brain, the single neuron that starts speaking voluntarily without a prompt? For that to happen, we have to have a person come to the hospital, a surgeon opens their brain and puts electrodes around the suspected region. So we already have some indications before based on signatures of your seizure on where potentially the kind of mischievous neuron sits. Now we put electrodes in your brain and you connect the electrodes to a computer. And this computer now for the next couple of days records your brain activity continuously while we wait for you to have a seizure. So the point now is that we want you to have a seizure, because when you have a seizure, we can actually use our electrodes in your brain to monitor the flow of the seizure and see which neuron started speaking first and figure out which is the kind of bad neuron. And then after you had maybe three or four seizures and we are certain that we found the right one, we take the electrodes out, we knock out this one neuron, we close everything, and we send you back home seizure-free. So you're fixed. You don't have epilepsy anymore. You don't live with medications. You don't live under some stress for the rest of your life. You're fixed. That's the clinical setting. But it also means that we now have a human being with open brain, electrodes inside, sitting in a hospital for 2 weeks, waiting to have a seizure. So in between seizures, it's just a regular person who sits and watches TV, talks to their friends, but their brain is open and they have wires inside. And this gives scientists like myself the opportunity to come to the guy and say, you know, you're right now sitting here waiting for a seizure. That's the clinical part. But in between, you don't really do much. You watch movies. Do you mind, instead of watching movies, watching a computer game where you make decisions between, I don't know, A and B, and I can see how the brain works from the inside and understand really how you decide between A and B, or I can zap a neuron and see if it makes you choose something. So that's the setting that I work in. We have the patients come because of the clinical purposes. We offer them a chance to participate in studies independently of the clinical purposes. And those studies allow us to understand the brain of a human in the most direct way, because we see their neurons fire while they make decisions. We can ask questions that tell us exactly how thinking works in the brain. That's the setting.
Oh, that's so funny. So, yeah, look, while the top of your head's off and while your brain's exposed, and look, after you eat breakfast, I was just wondering if I could whack these wires on your frontal lobe and we could see what's... Yes, Tip?
I have a question. What are there other repercussions that happen when you remove one neuron, behavioral or function-wise?
So I would say the following. So the case of our patient is easy. There are none, because what we remove are damaged neurons. So the neuron that we take out is one that already causes problems. So taking it out doesn't make you lose anything. But as a thumb rule for the listeners, do not remove neurons in people's brains. Like the fact that you know, we can remove some and it doesn't change anything is mostly because the damage already happened. These people already have bad memory because those neurons are acting out. So now we take them out, they don't lose anything. But if you take a regular person and remove neurons, you might cause damage. I would say, to be even more precise, that the brain is quite redundant. So if you really remove a single neuron, it probably will not change much. The brain has enough copies and so on, but it's very hard to remove one neuron. People usually remove tissue, and tissue means millions of neurons, and millions of neurons are surely going to change something. So do not remove neurons from the brain at all.
Oh, I'm so excited. All right. Gosh. So what's the pie in the sky for you? What's the, this is what I want to do in the future. This is what I hope to learn or cure or understand. And I'm sure there's 20 things on that list, but maybe narrow it down a little.
So there's three things that every neuroscientist should answer are the things that we are interested in. And I'll give you my current take on one of them. The three things that every neuroscientist should answer to what is the kind of big thing are consciousness, free will, and dreams. Those are the three. If we understand one of those three, we're kind of in a different world. It's like quantum physics or classical physics to Newtonian physics. Those are the things that if you make the leap, that's it. Things are going to look different. If we can understand how consciousness works, build one. If we understand how free will works, it's kind of like the Big Bang for physics. We know what happened in the beginning. those are the ones. So that's where I also am interested in finding the answers. The closest thing we're making progress with right now is dreams, which are a mini version of those. That's a state where your consciousness is dormant. It's not really there. You kind of lose consciousness before and you regain it when you wake up. Yet your brain is still active and we can still do things with your brain. So right now where I spend most of my time in these type of research aspects with patients and you know electrodes in their brain is when they're dreaming. We have the patient go to sleep with electrodes inside their head and we try to look into their brain when they're not there, so to speak. They're kind of not conscious. And we try to still see if we can read their dreams, influence their dreams, change their awake behavior by doing something to their dreams. And that's where I think we're making good progress. My guess is that we're soon would be able to A, give an answer to what dreams are for and how to manipulate them, but also create products and commercial applications for dreams that will make it accessible to everyone. So it won't be just patients with electrodes in their brain, but it would be Tiff and Craig going to sleep and having a dream that is somehow more pleasant, or if they're a bad one, it's going to wake them up. Maybe share a dream. So two people who go to sleep side by side can actually have a dream that's joined, as in they're both each other in the dream. All kinds of fantastical ideas that are now in the lab and will soon become, I think, products.
What about, what? Oh my God. What about, look, notice I'm not going anywhere. Notice I'm still talking. What about learning while I'm sleeping? How far away are we from that?
So that's exactly what we're looking into right now. I'll give you the bad news and the good news. The bad news is that no lab out of the few that are looking at it has found a way to actually take a person, have them go to sleep, and wake up knowing something they didn't know before. So they, you know, go to sleep and you wake up knowing Kung Fu, doesn't work. this no one, even though that's the aim. What we did succeed in, and that's by we, I mean multiple labs, and it's kind of where a lot of the effort is spent right now, is to have you learn something when you're awake before you go to sleep, and then go to sleep, and the scientists will actually make your brain strengthen that. So we're gonna make your brain rehearse the thing that you learned when you're awake overnight, such that when you wake up after the night, you know it even better. You actually stronger memories, better decision-making processes and so on, but you still had to put it in yourself. And that's where we go. It's not what people want. They want to learn, you know, Chinese overnight, not happening. But if you learn Chinese a little bit before, we can make your brain practice enough that, such that you wake up, you actually know it better than you would if you didn't go through the process. So that's a step towards learning overnight.
Wow. Amazing. Well, Miran, we appreciate you so much being on the U Project and thanks for taking some time. How do people follow your research or connect with you? Or do you have any books? I should know that. Have you written any books?
I did. So none of them is the one that I would kind of recommend a regular person to read. They're all kind of textbooks and they're, you know, they're detailed and they're, so nothing that I would say kind of, hey, go and read the answer to those things. At some point I will, but for now I would say if you're really interested in understanding how single neuronal codings, that's the name of the research on patients, works, we have a book just about that. If you're really interested in how to use neuroscience in business, we have a book about that. We have academic papers that talk about the details of what I said about dreams and so on. I would say that for now you have to really want to understand those topics in order to get those books, because they're for academics.
Yeah, they're a little heavy. And are you on social media?
I am, but not really as active as one should be. The easiest way to find me is I'm like a scientist. So if you type my name, you find my website. And on my website, I try to put every now and then, like within a week or so, every podcast lecture. This one will be there too as soon as it's out. I try to curate as much as I can over the website that I manage. And I would say more than anything, because I'm a scientist and I feel it's my duty to actually interact with people about and talk to them about their work, I respond to my email when people ask me questions. It takes sometimes days, but if someone hears this and says, wait, I want to know more about learning Kung Fu because I think I have a way to teach people overnight, if they email me, they get a response.
Well, don't say that. You just opened up a can of worms. Well, that's amazing.
And my email is tiffanycook@gmail.com.
That's right. That's exactly right. Can you stay on the call? We're going to say goodbye. Can you stay there for a moment? Because I want to rebook you.
Of hey, course, Tip, pleasure.
Tip, amazing. Well done, you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Moran.
I'm taking you back off probation, so you now got your job again. Moran, thank you so much for being on the U Project.
It's a pleasure. I look forward to hearing that. And if you want me to help in any way in getting it out there, let me know and I'll do my best.
Perfect. Stay there for 1 second. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, listeners. Thanks, followers. Love your guts.